Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, the Murdochs under fire. White-knuckled debate over the debt ceiling and the country sizzles. News Corp chief Rupert Murdoch testified on a huge phone hacking and corruption scandal before a parliamentary committee in London.
I would just like to say one sentence. This is the most humble day of my life.
With the clock still ticking, the Senate's Gang of Six has a debt plan. Republican Tom Coburn said it's high time to make a deal.
What is not acceptable is not having a plan and delaying reform until some perfect political moment that will never arrive.
And a massive heat wave blasts the nation with record temperatures and high humidity.
Chicago's bracing for 110 heat index today. In Minnesota yesterday, it was 134. Now, the only other place in the world where that type of heat index is common is the Red Sea off of Saudi Arabia.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Nancy Cordes of CBS News, Clive Crook of the Financial Times, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. You can join the conversation. Are we headed for a debt ceiling wipeout, a breakthrough? Will the Murdoch scandal come here? Are you hot enough? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Washington is Nancy Cordes, congressional correspondent for CBS News. Nancy, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Also with us from Washington is Clive Crook, chief Washington commentator at the Financial Times, columnist for National Journal, senior editor at The Atlantic. Clive Crook, welcome back to you as well.
Hi, Tom.
And hello, Jack.
Yes, hello, Tom.
Hi, great to have you with us. Nancy Cordes, take us into the very latest here. There's still headlines coming out about some kind of grand bargain, but all kinds of pushback and demur. What do we know about what's going on this debt ceiling? I don't know if negotiation's even the right word, but situation.
I don't think even most of the folks on Capitol Hill really, truly know what's going on, Tom. So you're in good company.
Okay.
But essentially what we know right now is that around midday on Thursday, word started to leak out that the president and Speaker Boehner were close to a deal. And from congressional Democrats, we were hearing some of the outlines of this deal, which would involve about $3 trillion in spending cuts. But what got Democrats really hot under the collar was that the deal wouldn't include any of the upfront tax increases that they had been pushing for as part of what they called a balanced deal. The contours of the deal would involve comprehensive tax reform at some point in the future, maybe a year from now, to give Congress time to work through it. So there would be the promise of increased tax revenues down the road, but that was not good enough for Democrats because, as you know, if you tell Congress to do something in the future, the chances that they're actually going to get their act together and do it are not very good.
We don't know, in that case, what's going on. Clive Crook, remind us of the stakes here. Europe dealing with some of its Greek debt and default fear issues this week. But what about the stakes as the United States continues toward this August 2nd date, Clive?
Yeah, well, they couldn't really be any higher, I think. Everyone is taking it for granted, and the markets are taking it for granted, that a deal of some kind is going to be done in time to avoid a default. But, you know, the closer we get to the deadline, the more risky that looks. And if we do actually hit the deadline and do have to have a technical default, who knows what will happen? I mean, the downside of that is terrifying. I mean, it could be a rerun of the crisis of 2008. It could be as bad as that. You know, the fact that these guys are playing around with this thing and not getting the problem fixed is staggering to me, frankly.
As bad as 2008, maybe worse. I mean, that was Lehman Brothers. This is the United States of America, full faith and credit and all that. Here's some tape from David Kotok, chief economist at Cumberland Advisors, telling NPR this morning that allowing the U.S. to default on its debt would be catastrophic.
The Treasury note is the single most important security. It cannot default. It would be a horror story globally. The politics of this are insane. You run the risk in a default by the United States of a catastrophic meltdown like we saw when Lehman Brothers failed or AIG failed, only much larger.
There was talk at midweek of maybe something coming out of the Senate and its gang of six. Nancy Clive, Jack, listen here. Was to that brief period of what happy posy. Here's Democrat Dick Durbin of Illinois describing the mood of the gang of six meeting.
There were no fistfights. There was no swearing. Instead, Democrats and Republican senators sat in that room, 49 of them, listened to the outline of this group of six proposal and came out with a positive feeling.
Positive feeling, but that won't cut it. On Thursday morning, Republican Senator Jeff Sessions from Alabama, senior ranking member of the Senate Budget Committee, appeared on Fox News, America's newsroom, expressed deep concern over the Gang of Six plan.
It raises current tax rates by $1 trillion. It only cuts spending, it appears, by $1.2 trillion. So this is really an insufficient response. The problem we've got in Washington is the surge of spending that's been going on. We've increased non-defense discretionary spending 24% in the last 2 years. This is where we've got to focus our emphasis. We can't ask the American people to send more money to bail out reckless spending.
Jack Beatty, what do you see unfolding here at this point?
Well, I'm reading that Senator Reid has said that Speaker Boehner and the president have 48 hours to work out their deal. If they don't, he's got to start the machinery of the McConnell Plan Z, the backup plan we heard about last week. Mm-hmm. And that, the timing on that is perilous. It would take at least until Friday to work through the Senate. And then because of the House rules, it would take about 72 hours to work through the House, which would be put it on the president's desk on Monday, the day before the debt ceiling gets pierced. So it couldn't be more last minute or dramatic and really frightening.
Nancy, we heard from Clive and from others all week about the pressures to do something here. Lots of American business leaders saying, what is going on? Fix this. And not to mention many others. But what about the pressures not to do something like the things that have been laid on the table? Where's that coming from, Nancy?
Well, I think you have a number of House Republicans in particular, especially freshman Republicans who came in as part of this Tea Party wave, who don't believe that the consequences of piercing the debt ceiling will be as grave as they are being told. Now, over the past couple of weeks or so, some of them have been coming around. Just on Thursday, S&P, some officials from that ratings agency actually came to speak to a number of House Republicans to explain to them how grave the consequences could be. And they've also seen the poll numbers, Americans basically saying, look, we want compromise here, and both sides need to give. So that is changing a bit. But what isn't changing is their belief that there should not be any increased tax revenues as part of this deal. Republicans were the ones, remember, who said, we will vote to raise the debt limit by about $2.4 trillion, but you need to reduce the deficit by the same amount. And then Democrats came back and said, okay, well, we'd be willing to do that, but you've got to have a mix here. It can't just be spending cuts. It's also got to be some increased tax revenue. That's where Republicans are balking right now. And now that the president is making this deal with Boehner, supposedly that puts off tax revenues, now Democrats are the ones who are crying foul. And so the question isn't just whether they have time to vote on something by August 2nd, but whether they'll all agree on whatever is on the table.
Obama and Boehner both in a real political vice here. The House passing the cut, cap, and balance legislation this week, cut spending, cap spending, and have a balanced budget amendment in the United Constitution. At least get started on that. A lot of pressure not to give at all here, so much that yesterday House Speaker John Boehner called into Rush Limbaugh's radio show to deny that he and the president had already struck a deal on the debt ceiling.
Well, Rush, there is no deal. No deal publicly, no deal privately. There is absolutely no deal.
Are you talking about a deal, though?
Pardon me?
Are you talking about a deal in secret?
Our focus right now is getting the Senate to follow us in the House and pass cut, cap, and balance.
Clive Crook even talking about a deal. Rush Limbaugh wants to know if that's going on. The implication there, he does not want it. How do you read the politics of this and the possibility of a breakthrough, Clive?
Well, I think there will, as I said before, you know, I do think there'll be a breakthrough, there'll be a deal, and it probably will be at the very last minute. I think enough people on the Hill understand that a default will be a disaster, but, you know, each side is very scared about being the first to blink. But what I think is interesting, and this, you know, the clip you just played from Rush Limbaugh mm-hmm. illustrates this very well, is that, you know, in this situation, the president and John Boehner have actually at times seemed almost like allies. You know, they had been trying to strike a deal. And I think at one stage, Obama thought he had an understanding with Boehner about a deal, a balanced deal, that would give Republicans what most Republicans, I think, would have regarded as a victory, a lot of spending cuts for not much revenue increase. And it was the, you know, freshman House Republicans who were determined not to budge an inch on taxes that vetoed that. So, you know, Obama and Boehner, I think, left to their own devices, would have solved this problem by now. The problem is in the Republican Party, the guys who won't move on taxes, but also now increasingly on the Democratic side, that they're outraged by the notion that Obama might, you know, might give away the whole deal and there'd be spending cuts and no meaningful revenue increases. That's the problem.
Yeah, we'll look at that. Jack, in a word before the break here, can you picture a grand bargain coming out? Lots of talk and lots of headlines, lots of big numbers, $3-4 trillion. Can you picture it?
I can picture it in an alternate universe. In this one, no. I do think that the Plan Z, if I were a betting man, I'd say it's the McConnell sort of the punt is far more likely. But we'll have to see.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Debt crisis at a boil. Murdoch's on the hot seat. Last space shuttle comes down. Heat wave and a big explosion today in Oslo, Norway, hitting the prime minister's offices, the building they're in, there. Nancy Cordes is here from CBS News, Clive Crook from the Financial Times, and Jack Beatty, our own news analyst. Let's hear from the president. He's been in these grand bargain conversations apparently as well, maybe ever since back on the golf course with John Boehner a few weeks ago. In an interview with Michelle Martin for NPR's Tell Me More, it airs today, President Obama was asked what was included in the Gang of Six plan that made it more appealing to him. He spoke very favorably of it than previous proposals.
Actually, it's not so much that it's hugely different from some of the previous frameworks that were, for example, put out by my fiscal commission or that I talked about several months ago. What was different was that you had Republican senators acknowledging that revenues need to be part of a balanced package. And you had Democratic senators acknowledge that we're going to have to make some difficult spending cuts in order to achieve the kinds of debt and deficit reduction that are important to the economy.
Some Democratic senators and others acknowledging that. Nancy Cordes, let's talk for a minute about Democratic resistance to a grand bargain here. What are the points where Democrats in the House or Senate, for that matter, are pushing back on the president? Reports of them quite unhappy with his budget director, you know, sort of getting into shouting matches mm-hmm. this week.
Right. They were very angry. Jack Lew came down to the Capitol for what was supposed to be just kind of a routine lunch meeting with senators on the Democratic side. But during the course of that meeting, the news started to leak out about this deal between the president and Speaker Boehner, and they just kind of went ballistic on him in the meeting. And so that's why you saw the White House furiously backtracking, saying there's no deal. We're far from a deal. But I think by and large, Democrats have come to accept that they are going to have to live with some entitlement cuts and some overall spending cuts in domestic outlays in order to get a deal. I think that they've been fine with that for quite some time. Their only demand is that this be what they call a balanced approach and that you get increased revenue from taxes as well, not necessarily increasing people's income tax rates, but rather closing some corporate loopholes and that sort of thing to raise revenue. And of course, what they love to see is the Bush tax cuts eliminated for families making over $250,000 a year. That's probably not going to happen, at least right away. But what really is angering them right now is just the rumor, the possibility that the president might be willing to sign that away and agree to a plan that only includes spending cuts right now and puts off comprehensive tax reform for about a year. And what that tax reform would look like, it's very similar to what we've seen in the Gang of Six proposal, is eliminating some personal deductions, or reducing them at least, things like deductions for home ownership, charitable deductions, in exchange for reducing everyone's income tax rates pretty significantly. We're hearing that there would be some kind of trigger in the deal so that if Congress couldn't do that, if they couldn't achieve comprehensive tax reform by 2012, then automatically those Bush tax cuts for the wealthy would be eliminated. Democrats are crying foul there, too. They say, look, those tax cuts are scheduled to be eliminated at the end of 2012 anyway. So how is this a good deal for us?
Harry Reid not sounding very happy at all about a deal. What's the head count? I mean, could Democrats end up blocking a deal that their president strikes with John Boehner?
I think they could, especially if there are no revenues up front, or if there is not an ironclad promise that there will be revenues raised down the road.
Go to Jerry in Indianapolis, Indiana. Jerry, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello. I was just curious if in history, if the debt ceiling has ever been focused as highly as it is now, and especially with the formulation of like the Gang of Six, and if this ploy by the Republicans of the stalemating the president's thoughts are on his staff.
Yeah, Jerry, let us pick it. Has it ever happened before? I mean, Jack, I guess first to you, are we in unprecedented territory? It certainly feels that way. It's been raised countless times over the years. That's how you get to all these trillions in debt,
yeah.
I guess. 14.3. Well, you know, what about precedent, Jack? Have you ever, can you think of a moment where the debt ceiling or anything else had quite this much kind of doomsday scenario leverage in Washington?
I can't. It's been raised 70 times since the Kennedy administration, over 70 times. It was raised 7 times under President Bush, John Boehner, Mitch McConnell voting for it. You know, it defines a normal task of government, politically painful but vital. And the Republicans would almost certainly raise the debt ceiling under a Republican president. They'd have to do it for years under their Ryan budget, but not under President Obama. You know, it appears they're trying to stop the government from working so long and only so long as President Obama is in office. Just last week, for example, an example of this, Lamar Smith, chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, introduced a bill that would stop the Obama administration from using discretion in deportations. The bill, Smith told his colleagues, would restore these powers to the president elected in 2012, if it's a Republican. That's quite a...
that's amazing. Clive, look at this with a little bit of a transatlantic perspective. Europe is wrestling with its own huge fiscal and finance issues, wrestling with Greece this week, and has come to some kind of deal there, at least for the moment. But when you look at the U.S. crisis, many critics of the Republicans have said this is a manufactured crisis. As Jack said, if it were a Republican president, they would no doubt raise the ceiling. This is a, you know, critics say it's an ideological kind of kamikaze mission going on here. Do you see it that way? Or when you look at Europe and its problems, you know, is the U.S. at a moment where it really does have to fix the debt situation, Clive?
Well, I think, you know, paradoxically, Europe's problems are actually helping the U.S. right now, because one of the reasons the markets are still buying U.S. government debt is because the European alternative has looked so shaky lately. Mm-hmm. You know, if the European economy was humming along, then I think the U.S. would have confronted a much more difficult situation much faster in this controversy. So that's the oddity of the situation. But if Europe should go wrong and then the U.S. should go wrong, of course, that really is a doomsday scenario. If they both screw up together, then we are in the deepest kind of trouble.
Let's go to Penelope in Norwich, Vermont. Penelope, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yes, I'm wondering if anyone there is as outraged as I am that an unelected person, Grover Norquist, is behind this anti-tax business and is holding the U.S., our elected president, and in fact the whole economic system of not only America but of the whole world, hostage to his will.
Grover Norquist, president of Americans for Tax Reform. He's been an anti-tax crusader for a long time now. He's got a lot of company now with that freshman class of Tea Partiers. But, Nancy, how about it? The Norquist influence at this point, he's in the Washington Post or New York Times today. You know, once again, read my lips, no new taxes.
Well, he certainly does have a lot of influence, although there are certainly a number of of members on the Republican side who share his dogma. And I think the problem with his pledge for Republicans now is that it is so absolute. Not $1 in tax increases will we accept. And you know, which means that we won't close a loophole that says hedge fund managers only have to pay 15% of their income as opposed to the people who work for them paying 35% of their income. I mean, they are against closing any loophole whatsoever if it would raise tax revenue. And because they have set that out as their negotiating position from the very beginning, all the Republicans all the way up to Speaker Boehner, it's difficult now to compromise, because if you agree to even $1 in tax increases, you've lost. So I think that's the challenge that the speaker is having now in coming up with an agreement with the president, is that their bargaining position has been so absolute for so long. It really worked in their favor early on to set the terms of the debate. Now, closing the argument, closing the deal, is very, very difficult.
Democrats arguing that puts all the weight of a fix on the middle class and the poor. Mark in Madison, Connecticut. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I'm a little, I just get very frustrated listening to all this talk about, you know, the deficit. Obviously, we're in a very serious situation, $14 trillion. It's going to take forever to pay it off. And we're listening to these career politicians who have gotten us into this mess in the first place, trying to tell us how to get out of it. And it seems to me that the new blood is the people that we have to be listening to, because the establishment politicians have already proven that they can't get us out of it.
Do you trust the new blood not to get us fixed here and not drive us off a cliff, Mark?
Absolutely. I think they can't do any worse than what we've gotten into already.
Clive Crook, what about that perspective? Trust the new blood, the freshmen, congressmen, Republicans, Tea Partiers. You know, $14.3 trillion's enough. Let's just go with the new guys.
Well, I think it would be a big mistake to ignore that sentiment, to ignore that strand of opinion.
Mm-hmm.
They obviously speak for a large part of the country. And actually, you know, I hear an awful lot of sense in what they say. I think they've chosen the wrong fight over the debt ceiling, because there is so much at stake in this thing.
But when else would they have this kind of leverage? I mean, that's
well, that
exactly
is, of
what
course, that is what they say. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it's like, they're threatening to use the nuclear option. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if they understand it, that it really is the nuclear option.
I mean, you got business leaders saying we could be in a new Great Depression. On the other hand, these guys are desperate for that leverage. Carl in Nashville, you're on, Carl.
Hi. My frustration is the frustration that no one will call these people out. Ever since this president, this black American president, has been in office, it seems like the Republican Party has done everything damn near short of destroying the economic stability of our country ever since this man been president. And we can't say, oh, it's just a Democratic president. No, it's much more deeper than that. And I'm sick of people dancing around the edges. Let's be straightforward and say these people do not want a black man as president of America. They would destroy America to see this man out of there. And it's just as simple as that. No one will say it. And if you say, well, Carl, prove it. Well, look at what they've done over the past 2.5 years. Just the simplest things, like the raising the debt ceiling that Ronald Reagan did, what, 12, 13, 14 times?
Mm-hmm.
George W. Bush did it 7 times. Clinton did it a few times.
Mm-hmm.
No one has ever made this a big topic until this man has been president. This party, the Republican Party, has stood in front of progress of our country for the past 2.5 years, and it's about damn time that someone calls them out for what they are, an obstructionist, borderline racist party.
Carl, we've got it. Jack Beatty, speak to that. A party willing to burn down the whole barn to hit out at Obama, the first black U.S. president. What do you say, Jack?
Well, I Carl talks about evidence. It's hard to see evidence clearly of that. One can certainly suspect it. This much is true, and it does go back to Grover Norquist. He's been quoted recently as saying, we want to make it impossible for a Democratic president to govern as a Democrat. Now, I think that's pretty much what they're trying to do. He can govern, but as a Republican, although I think they're not even allowing him here to govern as a Republican with the debt ceiling. But so I really don't know about the race issue. I certainly know about the party issue. The Republican Party regards the Democrats as really sort of illegitimate, and not, this was true under Bill Clinton, not having the right to represent, you know, in other words, the people voted for them, but that was a mistake, and they're going to correct it at the next
election. Yeah, that's
election.
Pretty, I mean, but if you won't let somebody govern as a Democrat or a Republican, that doesn't, I don't know, that may speak to Carl's point, maybe. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Jason in Montreal, Canada. Jason, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My question is much more broad than the specifics of the debt crisis in the United States. Because in my opinion, it seems as though the monetary system in general is flawed. And the more and more that we create these unions of countries, I think it's going to expose the flaws in the monetary system and how it functions on debt. And it doesn't work without debt. And I wanted to ask the question to your guest, is the monetary system a long-term, will it function long-term? And I think from what we're seeing is it's starting to fail.
The monetary system itself failed. Yeah, it sounds a little bit Ron Paul-ish there coming in from Montreal, Jason. But Clive Crook, what about it? I mean, do we have something wrong with the whole system or just the way we're using it?
There has been something wrong with the whole system. I mean, that's what the that's what the Great Recession shows. It raises tough questions about how the financial system should be constructed and how it should be regulated. And I think, you know, there's actually been some progress on that. We've just had the first anniversary of the Dodd-Frank bill, which I regard as a flawed piece of legislation, but nonetheless a step in the right direction. And, you know, that's 2,300 pages of legislation aimed at recasting the financial system to solve some of the flaws. But could I just come back and say a word about I think this argument about who's to blame here, mm-hmm. Republicans or Democrats? I do think, as I said before, that I think a lot of the blame attaches to the intransigence of the Republican side. But a lot of this also goes both ways. I mean, I just want to remind people that Obama voted against an increase in the debt ceiling during the Bush administration.
Yeah.
So he has played that card himself in the past. Although the debt ceiling thing is much more urgent, much more of a crisis now than it was then, nonetheless, he voted against an increase in the debt ceiling. And in the clip we just heard of Obama saying why he supported the Gang of Six proposal. And he said it was new, that for the first time, Democratic senators and Republican senators were getting behind a balanced plan. That was actually not correct. The Gang of Six plan is really Bowles Simpson mm-hmm. for slow learners.
Yes.
Everything that was in the Gang of Six plan was in the Bowles Simpson proposal. And where was Obama when that was first put on the table? He didn't back it.
It was a pretty...
And following up on what Clive is saying, I mean, mm-hmm. one thing you do have to give House Republicans, and particularly the freshman Republicans, credit for is that if they weren't insisting on this, no one would be talking about $3 trillion in debt reduction. You would not see the political will in Washington to do something big about the debt at all.
Yep.
They are the ones who are saying, look, we're going to get in big trouble down the road if we don't reduce our debt. And so you have to say that if it wasn't for them, probably this problem would be going unsolved.
Quick That's call right. before the break. Jerry in Cookeville, Tennessee. Half a minute before the break. Jerry, what have you got?
Hey, yes. Well, the last caller, I mean, I've heard this man before, and all he does is throw the race card out there. And it gets kind of old. It just shows people that they really have no argument except calling people racist. I just find it quite amazing.
Well, I mean, if you're African-American, you might consider the race card, given our history, but you don't buy it in our current reality?
What about Congressman Allen West? I wish he was president of the United States.
Yeah, African-American, Floridian.
And racist?
Yeah, Jerry, we'll let that one hang right there, and I appreciate your call as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, a growing famine crisis in Somalia. Here's Jerry Rawlings, African Union envoy to Somalia from a refugee camp on the Kenya-Somalia border.
The mothers and the children, I'm not sure many of them will be alive in the next week or two.
And boy, can you hear just how bad it is on the ground there. The last space shuttle lands for the last time. Lots of emotion, questions. On the landing strip at the Kennedy Space Center, Atlas Atlantis Commander Craig Ferguson said it was the end of an era.
Mission complete, Houston. After serving the world for over 30 years, the space shuttle's earned its place in history and it's come to a final stop.
And U.S. women's soccer loses to Japan in the Women's World Cup in a stunning penalty kick shootout.
USA, who thought they had it won twice, are beaten.
We're looking at a week in the news, and boy, is there a lot going on. We'll turn to the Murdoch scandal. What do you make of that? What about the last space shuttle coming down? Are you roasting in the heat? Is Rush Limbaugh right? Is the government exaggerating? And what are you thinking about borders closing down, Michelle Bachmann's migraines, Harry Potter's last stand, that U.S. women's soccer team? Clive Crook is with us from the Financial Times, Nancy Cordes from CBS News, and our own Jack Beatty. Lots of comment here online. We've got listeners saying, no secret Boehner-Obama deals. Fastest way to solve this, lock Congress in its taxpayer-funded chambers and shut off the taxpayer-funded air conditioning. Sounds like a poke from the right. Here's Mari on the other side going on about Republican anti-tax fiscal terrorists in D.C. Since when is hostage-taking considered governance? And here's another listener looking to the skies, thinking about the last space shuttle coming down, thinking about the United States in space. The inspiration to do something great, she writes, was a big part of our generation, provided by the space program. The losses we will suffer and the world are hard to calculate. I want to turn to Rupert Murdoch and that riveting testimony we saw from him and his son James before a committee of the British Parliament this week. Here on Tuesday, he was asked a pointed question by MP Jim Sheridan on that parliamentary committee.
Mr. Murdoch, do you accept that ultimately you are responsible for this whole fiasco?
No.
You're not responsible. Who is responsible?
The people that I trusted to run it, and then maybe the people they trusted.
Do you accept that you're ultimately responsible, Murdoch? No. Here's son James, heir apparent to the Murdoch Media Empire, News Corp Global, insisted at that hearing that News Corp enforces high standards of conduct.
Let me be very clear. The codes of conduct of News Corporation globally for our employees, journalists or otherwise, are very clear that breaking the law is a very, very serious matter. It should be, you know, people who are lawbreakers should be held to account. And in the matter of something like phone hacking or topically payments to police and things like that, we just don't think they should have any place in our business.
Phone hacking, police, corruption, payments to police, politicians in the pocket or afraid to speak up during the hearing on Wednesday. Rebecca Brooks, former editor of the now closed Murdoch-owned News of the World, later CEO of News International, his British operations denied responsibility for paying off British law enforcement while at the helm.
I can say that I have never paid a policeman myself. I've never sanctioned or knowingly sanctioned a payment to a police officer.
Now, Clive Crook, help us out here. We now are reading today that two former News International executives, Murdoch's operation there in the UK, are publicly contradicting James Murdoch's testimony, saying that they told him about evidence in 2008 that suggested phone hacking was going on. He had said in testimony that he didn't know. Could we see criminal charges here? Does it work that way in the UK, Clive?
I don't think the testimony that Murdoch gave to that parliamentary committee was under oath, so I'm not sure a charge of perjury arises. But if it turns out that he didn't tell the truth, of course he's insisting that he did tell the truth. He says he stands by his evidence. But obviously, if he's caught out in a lie, that would be enormously damaging to him. And who knows whether he would be able to stay on as head of the British part of News Corp? But most likely not. If it turns out that he lied to the committee, then he's gone.
Is this crisis crested in the UK? Is it in the rearview mirror for the Murdochs after their humble pie and almost
no.
cream pie and apology or not?
No, I mean, it is astonishing to me the way the scandal has continued to worsen every day. You know, staggering new development, and the one you just mentioned is the latest, you know, that Murdoch's testimony, James Murdoch's testimony, earlier this week has just been contradicted. So it just gets worse. I think at various points they've tried to do dramatic things, you know, to put a floor under the problem, starting with closing down, you know, the News of the World, which at the time was regarded as a staggering thing for them to do. But all of these attempts to bring closure to the issue have failed. They're still far from in control of the problem.
And the Prime Minister himself, David Cameron, having to defend himself before Parliament this week over his own ties to News Corp. Among other things, he addressed his hiring of Andy Coulson, former editor of News of the World, as his communications chief.
I regret, and I am extremely sorry about the furore it has caused. With 20-20 hindsight and all that has followed, I would not have offered him the job, and I expect that he wouldn't have taken it.
The furore, it's great to listen across the pond. Is the government secure in the UK, or could Cameron still fall on this, Clive?
I think it's very unlikely indeed that he'll fall. I thought he did pretty well in the statement he made to the Commons. You know, he was there for a long time answering questions in this sort of furious melee that goes on in the British House of Commons. And I thought he did pretty well. The thing that you have to bear in mind is that his links to News International, as embarrassing as they are not actually that unusual in British politics. I mean, all British politicians have been at it. You know, they all basically formed relationships with Murdoch and with other newspaper proprietors, because in Britain, that's something you need to do to succeed politically. So it's not as though what Cameron did was exceptional and extraordinary. Now, if he is caught out in some embarrassing particular, you know, there's something that he said he didn't do, and it turns out that he did. For instance, discussing with News International the bid for Be Sky B, and, you know, offering to help with that. Something of that kind would be extremely serious. But at the moment, I don't think there's any evidence that that has happened. And as long as there's nothing new and nothing worse, I think Cameron is likely to be okay.
British politicians needing to be on Murdoch's good side to make it in office. Hopefully the UK breaking that headlock in all this. Nancy Cordes, what about this? Jumping the Atlantic and coming here. Of course, Rupert Murdoch and News Corp, enormous holdings in the United States, the Wall Street Journal, Fox News, Fox television stations across this country, and more. We saw the FBI opened an investigation last week, we're told, into allegations that there may have been phone hacking here of families of 9/11 victims. Frank Lautenberg, Democratic senator, saying he's considering summoning Murdoch to Capitol Hill to testify. And then today, I'm reading here, Nancy, the Justice Department reportedly, the Wall Street Journal reporting, readying subpoenas as part of a probe into maybe attempts to hack phones here of September 11th victims. Can you see all this storm coming to the U.S., Nancy, or not?
I can see it coming, absolutely. And I think the one piece of good news for Rupert Murdoch is that Congress is so consumed right now by this debt debate that you don't see a lot of Democratic lawmakers in particular on the floor of the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate stoking this story and calling for his head. I think that if they were not just consumed, as I said, 24/7 by the debt, they would really be pushing this story, Democrats in particular, because of the rightward slant of a lot of his publications and his television operation. So it's a bit of good news for him that they're focused elsewhere.
Jack Beattie, quite a spectacle in the UK, not least with 80-year-old Rupert Murdoch's 42-year-old or something former volleyball champ wife Wendy Dung kind of vaulting into action there when a British something like comedian approached him with a plate full of pie cream to intending to put it in Murdoch's face right there in the committee meeting, and she's smacked that guy down. But what about what we've seen in the UK this week, Jack?
Well, you know, to me, it was the spectacle of the aging mogul losing his grip. He did seem to be, and to see him, you know, brought to bay by politicians who once licked his boots and now smell his blood running in the Thames. It's there's a ghoulish quality to it from people who truckled to him just yesterday. I note that before Cameron's election, 7 in 10 people in Britain agreed with the statement, people who play by the rules always get a raw deal. I wonder how many would say that in America. And you know, this coziness with both parties of this mogul is a sort, is sort of emblematic of that. Now, maybe he didn't get anything out of these relationships. Who knows? But it's the kind of thing that must confirm the British public in its cynicism, and I think sends a signal over here too about our media climate, and more than that, about our system of sort of politicians who govern for themselves. I mean, for example, the latest CBS poll says 53% name the economy and jobs as our biggest problem. Only 7% name the deficit, yet the political class is all deficit all the time. That's not representing the people.
And you've got to wonder exactly why. If those polls are right, Jack, let's go to Pittsburgh and Fred. Fred, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Listen, I just wanted to point out that it's worth pursuing the idea that the phone hacking wasn't just done for pursuing stories. Murdoch also may have pursued his own business interests using these same private investigators. A few years ago, your guest could probably help out here. Mm-hmm. There was a competitor to Sky in the UK that went under, and Murdoch's organization got busted for essentially distributing pirated set-top box encoding card.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Well, Fred, you're breaking up a little bit here, but I know you're asking about the possibility of phone hacking, not just around gathering news, but out of business interests. Now, News Corp, famously very aggressive in its business practices. In this country, it has had to pay out millions to competitors after it was found to have engaged in practices that, I don't know, illegal or unethical, I'm not sure, but bad enough that millions were paid out. Jack, what about phone hacking when it comes to business in this country? You know, you use it in the newspaper enough, it might be just tempting to use it to gain advantage on a deal.
Yeah, I saw a report last night that Senator Lautenberg is asking about that, because the business competitor allegedly hacked was a New Jersey company. Now, is anything going to come of that? We don't know. But that's out there.
I want to look at the Oslo situation with this big blast there today, and you may just be catching up this depending if you've been listening to the news. Reuters is reporting at least 8 people injured in an explosion that knocked lots of windows out of the 17-story in Oslo, the Norwegian capital, where the prime minister there, Jens Stoltenberg's office, is located, the building on fire after that blast. Now, Clive, Nancy, I don't know if you're plugged into this, but Al Jazeera TV is noting that Norwegian prosecutors this week filed terrorism charges against Mullah Krekar, founder of the Kurdish Islamist movement Ansar al-Islam, accused of threatening a former prime minister there. Big blast in Oslo, and it's been a while since we've seen that. The latest thing says car bomb. Clive, Nancy, do you have any sense of what the backstory may be here?
Sorry, I can't really help. I mean, of course, you know, that looks like a very striking coincidence, if that's what it was. But at the moment, I just don't think we know, you know, who's behind this. Of course, it's worrying. Everyone in Europe is going to be thinking, you know, Islamic terrorism again. We'll just have to see.
Mm. We're going to let that one sit right there. We will learn more as more news unfolds. Nancy, can we turn to that space shuttle for a moment this week? 135 flights over decades here, the crown jewel in recent years of the United States' presence in space, and watching the last one come down in the dark, and then the astronauts' words on board and the stillness that followed. There's no next flight being prepped here. NASA's future itself under so many questions, Nancy. What do you make of this, just for this country?
I know, and I think the Russians said this week that this is the age of Soyuz, which, you know, I think doesn't sit well with, you know, in my corner of the world and in Congress, it certainly doesn't sit well with a lot of members there. But it's a tricky situation, especially when they're talking about, you know, what a serious debt problem we have. NASA is certainly a very expensive undertaking. The shuttle was a very expensive undertaking. So talk has been kind of muted, because I think a lot of people there would like to see the space program, the shuttle program, continue, but it sort of runs counter to the prevailing winds in Congress right now, which is cut spending. So I think a lot of people noted it. We have some former astronauts in Congress, and they were very eloquent on the subject, just talking about how it's the end of an era.
American children. I've seen American kids talking about it. You know, it was very inspiring to be in a nation that had that kind of footprint in space. Latest coming in here, the U.S. Senate has voted to table the cut, cap, and balance bill passed earlier week by the House. As expected, it's going nowhere. What is going somewhere? John in Concord, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air.
Yes, a House committee voted to stop the Environmental Protection Agency from regulating carbon dioxide emissions. My question is, what can we do to protect the EPA so that they can save the country from global warming?
Yeah, here we are in the heat wave this week, and many wondering that same. It was a wild springtime of weather, and now a heat wave, the heat dome sitting over the country. And yes, there have been a lot of attacks on efforts to change that. I don't know, Clive Crook, look at this globally. U.S., Europe, is anybody getting a handle on this climate change issue?
Well, I think the short answer to that is no. I mean, the way you put the question is absolutely right, though. It is a global problem. There's no way the EPA can save us from global warming because we need a coordinated international effort to solve this problem. I do think that it would be a good thing if the U.S. led the way in this with some kind of cap-and-trade regulation or carbon tax. Maybe that's a good way to close the deficit. Let's have a carbon tax. But there's obviously very little appetite for that in the U.S., and the story is much the same in other countries, even though in Europe, for instance, governments say they're abiding by various international initiatives to get carbon emissions down, Kyoto Protocol and so forth. In fact, when you look at their performance, it's very disappointing. So we're all lagging on this.
Yeah. But meanwhile, Germany's saying, you know, getting off nuclear and all the rest into wind and solar in a very short order here. China moving ahead commercially on a whole lot of green efforts. The EPA cannot do it alone, quite right. But the world can't do it without the U.S. being engaged. And there we are, a plate full at the end of a summertime week and big mystery still on the fiscal future of this country and its economy. Clive Crook with the Financial Times joining us today from Washington. It's always great to have you, Clive. Thanks so much for being here.
A pleasure. Thanks.
Nancy Cordes with CBS News. Thank you very much indeed, Nancy. Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely, Tom.
And Jack, thank you. Have a great weekend, my friend.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.